Welcome to the Michelle Meow Show, your A through Z, covering the LGBT, LMNOP, and everyone in between show. I'm Michelle Meow. On Thursdays, I'm here at the Commonwealth Club, in which we tape the radio show for Progressive Voices with my co-host, John Zipper, of the Commonwealth Club.
Hey, Michelle.
It's so nice to be down here in the big girls' room. I'm going to call it the big girls' room. We're normally up on the third floor, although the third floor room has an amazing view.
It does have the view of the bay and the bridge, yes.
Yeah, but we're down here in the important room, the big girls' room, and that's because we have an important guest in which we'll talk a whole lot about LGBTQ issues, politics. He, when he was elected, was one of the youngest mayors in the country, definitely has made history as one of the youngest Asian American mayors, and one of the youngest out LGBTQ mayors. And now he serves as assembly member for his district, and I believe it's District 28. Let's welcome Evan Lowe to the program. Evan, welcome.
Hey, thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, I'm excited. This is the first time I actually get to sit and talk to you rather than listen to you. So it's tradition on this show that you share a coming out story. And I mentioned to you before we got started that you could be gay first here today.
So the coming out story?
Yeah.
There was not necessarily a good textbook way to do it. This was back in 2004 when the president of the United States also was engaged on talking about a national constitutional amendment to make marriage between a man and a woman, which would require ratification of 2/3 of the states. Right. So it was not an easy time to be at. We did not have a wide variety of the internet back then. I didn't have any friends, role models that I could look up to during this time. But what happened was I ran for office first. And this was back in 2004. And I remember I was at a political fundraiser that I was having, and there was a reporter who was going around to the different individuals in the room and saying, "Why are you supporting Evan Lowe?" Some people would say, "Well, we need a breath of fresh air." And then the next person said, "Well, he'd be the first person of color to be elected in the city's history. Wonderful." And then the next person said, "Well, he'd be the first openly gay person to be elected to the city council." I was not out at that time. And like I said, I did not have a sense of identity or coming out or who, what it was. It was a different time. And of course, the next day in the paper, it said, sure, "Evan Lowe, young Chinese American, 21 years old, openly gay, runs for city council."
Wow.
And my heart just dropped. I was nervous as heck because my parents, I was not out to my parents and my family.
Oh my.
And I was actually mad at the reporter because I said, "Would you have said about my opponent, 76-year-old Irish American, openly heterosexual, runs for city council? You wouldn't do the same thing." But yet this was sensationalism. So I had to tell my parents first and foremost. And my father was very loving, and my mother was very loving as well too. But it was very sloppy at how that came about. But sort of just sink or swim in that situation.
Oh, yeah. But when they make the movie of your life, that's going to be a great scene.
Almost like, I guess, you know, an indirect way of outing you in a lot of ways.
Do you think it was malicious at all, or just kind of going for the...
No, I think it was just a sensationalism of a story, that it was a unique characteristic of a candidate running that might connect with other individuals. It tells a story, perhaps, about a candidate. Certainly at the time, I felt that it was not conducive to what I wanted to accomplish or achieve. In other words, what about these attributes has anything to do with that of protection of public safety or funding of our roads and our infrastructure or water or sanitation or any things that city council members really focus on? But yet it was one aspect of myself, which now I can actually say that does play a key role into lawmaking.
Go ahead, John.
I was just going to say, once this was then out there, what did it play any role in the election, or did most voters say, "Yeah, we're interested in what you're going to do for the roads and that kind of stuff"?
Oh, I got all kinds of hate mail. This, again, was back in 2004, wow, a different time. I got hate mail saying we wanted American interests, not Chinese interests. Businesses in English, not in Chinese. Are you going to bring the gay agenda to the city of Campbell? And the strange thing is I'm fourth generation Californian, speaking more Spanish than I do Chinese. And so I was two generations more native to my community than many of the sitting elected officials. But yet I was seen as a perpetual foreigner.
You should have written back in Chinese.
That would have been, if I knew how to, I could write back in Spanish perhaps.
Well, right. You know, Google Translate will do that. Who knows if it's actual Chinese.
Or I should have responded in gay talk.
I was not surprised, but I laughed at an article that you had talked about certain people's responses and people saying, are you going to choke us with a gay parade? And I'm like, a gay parade in Campbell is an awesome idea. But continuing on in getting to know you, because it all somewhat ties into the policy work that you're involved with now. I'd love to hear just kind of what it was like to grow up in the South Bay, right? San Jose, born, not necessarily raised, because you moved to Campbell. And I've read articles in which your father has openly talked about, the first time he remembered or recognized that you would have a career in politics and being a community guy versus a kid he was trying to get into sports.
Yeah, it's my father is an optometrist, and so like a good Chinese boy, I was supposed to become a doctor, lawyer, or an engineer, and I didn't do that. I did politics, and sort of in the Asian community, politics is not really an area that you typically go into. Mm-hmm. In fact, I just came back from a conference referred to as the National Conference of State Legislatures, state legislators throughout the entire nation, and when you take a look at sort of the Asian caucus, and we said, okay, how many were actually there? You see far few between. And of course, of LGBT members, it's that much smaller. So we need to do a significant amount of work and representing the communities that we come from. But my father instilled those values of public service in me at a young age. And I think it's very important as we talk about, while in a capitalist society, what do we do to advance the interests of each other? In other words, how are we interconnected for each other's success? How is Evan Lowe invested in Michelle's success? How is Michelle invested in my success and vice versa in these different ways? And that's where I think the narrative should be at right now, with the call to service or civic engagement. And if you look at the voting population and the voter turnout of previous elections, even in the state of California, it is significantly low in terms of the type of engagement that we need to see.
As a LGBTQ person growing up in your adolescent years, I mean, you'd talked about, perusing books or going to the bookstore and kind of connecting with, gay books. And so when did it hit you that you're gay or that you're different? I mean, for many of us, like for example, myself, I'll just share it. I grew up watching soap operas, General Hospital, and I recognized that I really was drawn to Susan Lucci. So, what was that for you, or who, a moment?
I got to say, growing up in the Bay Area, I did not have a sense of identity with respect to what it meant to be LGBT. I didn't know anyone openly gay. There was no openly gay family members. I didn't see anyone on TV. No one that I could connect or relate to. Wow. And in the Asian community, sort of, it's even worse. It's the Chinese community, like, oh, there are no gay Chinese people. That doesn't exist. We don't talk about that. So the level of exposure was quite different back then. And it wasn't until I remember I was in class at a community college and someone had the Advocate magazine on their desk. And there were attractive photos of individuals on that magazine. And I tried to do more research and find out what that was about. I oftentimes also talk about wandering around aimlessly in Barnes & Noble and going through the gay and lesbian section pretending I was lost to try to find out what this meant because no one talked about it. And maybe the exposure that we saw was just on TV and sensationalism of gay pride and what individuals knew about the AIDS epidemic. So having a sense of what that meant was very challenging and difficult. So it was sort of a self-exploration.
Thank you for sharing that. I think that definitely connects and resonates with, API LGBTQ for sure. John.
So you won your city council race, right? And then how long after that before you decided to go for the mayor's seat?
You know, I lost in 2004.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I lost the first time, but thank you for reminding me about that loss.
How much did it hurt?
Yeah, painful memories. I lost in 2004 the first time, and I was 21, and then I ran again 2 years later. in 2006 and was successful that time around.
Okay. And when did the mayor's race?
Then we, in many cities in the state of California, you have a rotation of the city council and the mayor.
Oh, really? Okay.
So that happened in 2008-09, in which I assumed that role.
Okay. How long does the mayor then serve in that role?
Typically for 1 year, and then I served again back in 2013, I think.
And what was, you know, the people who had written you those nasty letters and said, oh, we don't want this, you know, Chinese person, this gay person who to be on our city council. When you were mayor, did you still get that kind of blowback from folks, or had they kind of become accustomed to the fact that, oh, okay, we see what he's doing?
Yeah, think about this. During this time, there was an issue called Proposition 8, a statewide measure that would verbatim eliminate the rights of same-sex couples to marry. Mm-hmm. Now, imagine that in the state of California, eliminating the rights of anybody. But yes, that passed. Voters voted to eliminate the rights of the LGBT community. I remember when I was serving as vice mayor, I went to the mayor's house at the time to do some preparation and meetings.
Yeah.
And I arrived at the mayor's home, and I saw not one, but two yes on Proposition 8 signs on her home, which, again, demonstrated her support as a sitting mayor, public official, to eliminate my rights, her vice mayor's rights. And I found that such a difficult time to deal with, and it was a very lonely time, frankly. Mm-hmm. And when you talk about what it meant to be mayor, I also tell this story why now it is very important that we demonstrate the talents of our community of identity. When I served as mayor, I received a letter from the Red Cross called the Summer Blood Challenge. During the summertime, many families are out and about, and so people aren't necessarily regularly in the routine of donating blood, so people are away. Mm-hmm. So they said, issued a challenge to mayors. Mayors, could you in the Silicon Valley region do a challenge and host blood drives and kind of host that and get blood donations? And again, it was a moment in time where it's just I started to sweat. I remember I opened the letter and I started to sweat because as mayor of a city, I could host a blood drive on City Hall property, but I couldn't donate blood myself because there's an FDA ban since 1983, a lifetime ban on gay men donating blood. And so I was struck by saying, do I prohibit discriminatory practices on public property, which we have a policy in place to do so, or do we host the blood drive and also bring light to these issues? We eventually hosted the blood drive and sought out an opportunity to highlight these issues and create public support against that.
Yeah.
Or when I host the Boy Scouts, they come in to earn their merit badge to meet with a public official. And when little boys ask, were you also in Boy Scouts, Mr. Mayor? Is that how you became mayor? Of course, gay men were not allowed in Boy Scouts. Or to officiate a wedding. As mayor, we can sign documents and officiate weddings, but I couldn't get married myself. So there are a number of things that I think are important for us to be present, be involved, mm-hmm. and to demonstrate who we are as individuals so that it can think, well, this doesn't make sense. And how do we advance the interests of our community?
You know, we were talking about this just earlier. The large numbers of people who think politics doesn't matter, it's all corrupt, it doesn't really affect my life anyway, either just totally upended or want to ignore it or something like that. Not only have you devoted your professional life to it, but these topics you're talking about, I mean, these are things that are very much affected by what we do through our political system. What would you say to folks who do kind of think, oh, politics, that's just nothing?
And think about it. I am so fortunate. As a millennial, I'm fortunate. I stand on the shoulders of generations who have come before us that in which there was criminalization for being who they were. Mm-hmm. And so much has changed, but yet we have so much to do.
Yeah.
In fact, in a majority of states, you can still be discriminated based on your sexual orientation or be denied service or hospital visitation rights or the issues of not being able to adopt. These are real issues or being subjected to a fraudulent issue of conversion therapy. Mm-hmm. But the issue is that you turn on the TV and you tell me that this doesn't matter or this will not impact you. And that's why when there's a march in the San Francisco airport, I'll go march in solidarity with the Muslim community. Because when you think about a ban, for example, talk about identity, the Chinese community was also impacted. In 1882, the Chinese Exclusion Act prevented migration from a geographic region to come to the United States. And you said, that's in 1882, that would never happen again. Well, in 2017 and today, the United States is doing the same damn thing. And we talk about the Women's March and that we actually have rights as to choose for ourselves, but you're seeing those issues being rolled back. And you see the March for Our Lives, you're seeing Gay Pride Movement. This will transcend all communities. And that's what's important. That's what's so critical for all of us. And the issues that face the LGBT community faces all communities.
Just listening to you, Evan, I now get like a good grasp of just how great you are in what you do. I mean, I've read some of the headlines and newspapers talking about how you've been so successful in getting bills passed and doing it so in kind of like a bipartisan way and getting, you know, other people who might not support you to support you. And so, you know, in my mind, I'm hearing you talk about this. I'm like, how does he do it? How does he talk to folks, you know, who aren't on the same team or that, you know, you've got to count the votes and get change made or, you know, get what you want, get these bills signed?
Well, let me tell you, I think there's a lot of us that stay in our own silos because it's comfortable to just stay in our own communities. And let me tell you a story about a situation in which I was able to get support. I had a bill proposal to lower the voting age from 18 to 17 in order to capture young people in the classroom and instill a lifelong sense of learning and habitual voting. And so there was a self-described arch-conservative Republican from Santee, kind of in San Diego County. And he's a Vietnam veteran, about 75 years old, Caucasian. And so I said, his name is Assemblymember Randy Vopel. And I said, can I come visit you in your district and take me to your favorite restaurant? So we went to a barbecue joint, and he served as mayor for a long period of time in Santee. And it was apparent because everyone knew him there, and he would pass out coins to kids and little boys who he presented at their baseball games.
Yeah.
But I sat down with him, and we broke bread and just got to know each other. After that lunch, this was about a Thursday, about 2 p.m., he said, what are you doing now? And I said, well, I have a few moments. He said, why don't you join me at my favorite redneck dive bar? And I said, okay. So I joined him. And of course, when we arrive at the bar, there are NRA bumper stickers and Trump bumper stickers everywhere. And I said, oh, goodness. I started to get a little nervous. But I go in there, and there are about 20 individuals and a lot of military folks because of the local base. Sure. But we had a beverage and we had a drink. And it was a good time to engage with people and just develop a common rapport. As I left, I said, Randy, I'm glad that we had this opportunity, but I expect you'll join me at the gay bars in San Francisco now as we go bar hopping. And he laughed and he said, I'll take you up on that. Fast forward to when the bill comes up for 18, lowering the voting age, the Republican recommendation is to vote no. He puts up his microphone and speaks in support of the bill. And he says, I'm supporting this bill because as a Vietnam veteran, at 17, you could have died for your country. And I saw my entire platoon being slaughtered. So if you can die for your country, you should be able to vote. I urge an I vote for this measure. And it was based on, and he actually told me, he said, hey, all the Republicans are thinking I'm crazy and they're suggesting I'm not. But we developed a level of trust and rapport and we build off of that. And I think that's so important for us to be able to do. And I've done so similarly with individuals who are in opposition to a bill that I also have with respect to conversion therapy. In fact, I just did that last week, meeting with religious community leaders who frankly were very blatant and said, we thought you were the devil, but we see something a little different.
It's good to hear you're doing that. We were reminded of the power of that cross-border just kind of recognition of humanity with the passing of Ron Dellums recently, because one of the things he was noted for was lifelong liberal, certainly on the left wing of his party, yet he got into power and even when he controlled a committee, he always talked to the Republicans. And Tom DeLay, you know, when Dellums left Congress, DeLay, who was of course an arch conservative Republican from Texas, called him, you know, the consummate gentleman and just, you know, pretty much a perfect congressman because of that. He saw him as a human being, and we might not agree, but you know, you do actually get stuff done.
And it's one of those things that as public officials, we are grappled with the challenge, which is that oftentimes of these conversations, it's about compromise and working across the aisle, being bipartisan and trying to represent a wide variety of communities. But this, in this political rhetoric, there are times on both sides, on the left and the right, that says do not compromise, because they would translate that as compromising your values, that your principles have been compromised, when in fact, it's not. There's nuance to it, and it's important to take a look at it situationally about what that means and how to get things passed and how to build off of a collective support.
Let's talk about LGBTQ issues very quickly. I mean, one bill that you've been talking a whole lot about is the bill to end paid conversion therapy. And it's easy to think, you know, California is so progressive. Like, I thought we passed, you know, laws banning conversion therapy long ago, but there's a difference as far as paid conversion therapy.
As you may know, in 2012, the state of California passed a law that would ban conversion therapy for minors 18 and under. That was signed. Since 2012, 14 other states have also joined us in this regard and also passed similar legislation. Fast forward to where we are today, the bill that I have is to qualify conversion therapy as a fraudulent practice to cover adults as well. And this is a very narrow in scope under the Consumer Legal Remedies Act. So just as a consumer or a transaction that's made in terms of goods and services, if you're provided a service that is what you expect it to be, that is under the law. But if it is considered fraud, how do we identify what is considered fraud? Which is that if I tell you, for example, Michelle, that you drink this coffee and I'm going to sell it to you for a dollar, you will grow a foot taller. That is fraud, because it would not work. You will not grow a foot taller, no matter how much you would like to see it happen. But if I gave you this cup of coffee for free and told you foot taller, that would be allowed under the law. And so this is what we're talking about, calling conversion therapy what it is, a fraudulent practice, and ensuring that we can protect individuals and hopefully can be a blueprint for the country and many other states as well.
And how is that whole fight going? I've read some pretty heated debates on both sides of it.
Yes, we've been fortunate to get bipartisan support with multiple Republicans supporting the bill.
Including your San Diego friend?
He unfortunately did not on this one, but I did go to him on this. Okay. But he said, no, absolutely, he would be scorned if he said he would do this as well. But we've been fortunate from another San Diego Republican and a Bay Area Republican, so two Republicans actually supported it. It's now in the Senate, but the narrative has been captured in such that this would ban the Bible. In other words, that folks in the religious community, practitioners would say, well, you can be changed. And it's unfortunate because in public testimony, this is another observation. In public testimony, we had maybe about 5 minutes of people speaking in support of the bill. Mm-hmm. Only 5 minutes of people coming and saying, me too, I me too, who spoke in support of calling conversion therapy fraud. And in fact, we had over 2 hours of testimony of individuals speaking in opposition. You had buses coming up to the state capitol speaking in opposition. And it was such an eye-opening experience for me, because when we talk about the LGBT movement, I genuinely feel that we've also gotten complacent because we've had such great wins. And it's important to cite this issue, but also to look at the United States Supreme Court and the decisions that they are making that will roll back many of the protections that we've been putting in place at a state level. So again, a call of urgency, if you will.
I love that you said that, you know, because I kind of felt the same, and then being part of the Pride movement, yeah, you know, questioning myself in terms of complacency. So I want to talk about immigration, especially in California. We have a lot of political leaders who are standing on a platform of standing proud, you know, being a sanctuary state or sanctuary city. But the problems of immigration definitely impacts the LGBTQ community. I'd love to hear from you as being an LGBTQ leader, a political leader who is also, you'd mentioned it earlier, being supportive of, you know, limiting what the federal government is currently doing to the immigrant community. Are we doing the best that we can as a state and even as a region?
Yes. Well, as you may know, we in the state of California have passed laws that are the strictest laws and to maintain the values that we care about. to be inclusive. We build bridges, not walls. And that is reflected in the bills that we have passed, which is no cooperation with the federal government on these raids when we're going after people for no fault of their own, whether it be in places of worship, in schools, or a public gathering. That is not something that we will support. Mm-hmm. There's the distinction also, though, if there's an individual who has committed a serious crime, that there is an opportunity to engage on that cooperation. But we should not be going into raids for no fault of individuals on their own. The reality is this, just as we talk about the intersectionality of LGBT and myself as API, we all have come to this experience. My family were paper sons, and that refers to the fires that happened that burned down all the immigration documents in California. And so many of the individuals who have come, including my family, came through the Angel Island and had to come up with an opportunity to figure out how they could become citizens in this country too. So the experiences should not be lost. That's why the historical context is so important for us to remember our history so that we repeat them, because we're seeing patterns of that being repeated. And oh, by the way, this protectionist view of those that are in opposition to say that, well, now that I have it, others shouldn't have it. But if you track back for the history of many other families and individuals, you'll find similar stories as well. But we are doing everything that we possibly can to making sure that we demonstrate the courage of our convictions and being a very inclusive society and remembering that historical context.
Thank you. John?
Oh, I mean, that's just one topic in which California is kind of, you know, the state of resistance, if you will, to the Trump administration. But, you know, that administration is going after California on a number of things. They just lost a case, I guess, in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals on denying money to cities that were sanctuary cities. But they're also going after our the mileage issues, you know, environmental things. How much do you think, I mean, how strong do you think California and other states that do want to, you know, stand up against the Trump administration, how strong do you think they are? I mean, can they last another 2 years and defend their people and their policies? Will they get worn down? I mean, give your sense of the state, if you will, of the state resistance movement.
Yeah, think about how absurd that this notion is, which is that the Trump administration has specifically targeted California on our pocketbooks. In fact, I was meeting with the California Society of CPAs, tax preparers, and they talked about how, yes, in fact, indeed, the federal administration is targeting states like California and hitting us where it hurts. Or even we're talking about the tariffs that have occurred with China and that having an impact on import and export. We are a large agricultural community. And so when you think about the issues in the areas of Fresno and Bakersfield and other places, how this does not fundamentally hurt other communities and individuals who identify as Republican. So if you are Republican in the state of California, how can you possibly not be in opposition on a wide variety of different measures? Mm-hmm. When it hits you, not only perhaps on your philosophy, on your political ideology, but specifically your pocketbook,
right,
and your livelihood. The number two Republican in Congress is from California, and yet they seem to just kowtow and placate to the Trump administration. So therefore, in the absence of their resistance, that is where the state of California is trying to do what we can, and that's where our attorney general has been very litigious and has sued on, I think, over 50 different occasions on various measures to ensure the state's rights. Mm-hmm. You know, that's oftentimes talking about an issue that you hear from a conservative angle, right, but you find that now that's the conversation that we're also taking a look at as well.
Speaking of financials and, you know, hitting them where it hurts, I mean, certain immigrant rights advocates are going down the road of trying to cancel these detention centers that are popping up across the state. In California, I mean, in Richmond, they were successful in Richmond, the city, canceling a detention center's contract there. What are your thoughts about this specific strategy in terms of canceling these contracts and getting rid of these private detention centers?
Well, it's important that when we as a state demonstrate who we are as people and that we will not cooperate with the federal government when they're going after our values and our people that are, again, for separation of families and doing no fault of their own, trying to obtain the California an American dream just like everyone else. Each of us, all of our families have immigrated and have tried to attain the same American California dream. And it's hard and difficult enough to even survive as we sit here in San Francisco. Even if you do have, even if you are naturalized and if you do have U.S. citizenship, how difficult it is just to survive and provide for your families. So how dare we not allow for an environment that helps people thrive? And in fact, we're setting up people for failure, not for success. And that's where we need to fight against where we can, on the, whether or not it's detention centers and other areas in which they're going after people who make us the diverse community that we are in the state of California.
We got a little bit of time, and of course, we want to leave some time for our audience to ask questions, ask Evan questions. So I think we'll do that. So then we'll come back to John and I with 10 minutes left. I think it's on.
If anyone has a question they want to ask.
Hi, Evan. Hi, Michelle.
Hey.
Can you just say a little more how you respond to the critics of the sexual orientation change bill? And there is there any legitimate concern that First Amendment would be violated by it, that the sale of a book, for example, would be prohibited, maybe even religious materials that talk about sexuality? Say more about how you are responding to those criticisms.
Sure. Yeah, if you look at the bill itself in terms of its language, it only refers to the sale or advertising of Changepiracy services, which is that of that you can be changed, that we can guarantee an outcome under a financial transaction. So simply the sale of a book is not prohibited under this bill. You can imagine how that would not, I mean, just in basic common sense, that would not muster the courts, and neither is the legislative intent. Additionally, when courts take a look at various cases, they'll look at legislative intent and the conversations and the rhetoric that we make as legislators as to factoring in what actually wants to occur. So it is absolutely not the banning of the Bible or goods or of this nature, but it's what's happened, unfortunately, is that it's gone out into the social media blogs and that people are just coming up to this sensationalism that's what it's about, when in fact it has nothing to do with that book, but it's actually that of the service of advertising. In addition, we also want to make mention that you can still practice conversion therapy just so as long as there's not a charge.
Evan, you said growing up you didn't have any role models that you saw that were gay or Chinese American and Asians, and you clearly right now are a role model for many young, both Asian American as well as gay and gay Asian Americans. What would you say to them? What is your message to them today?
Well, similarly, I mean, Ignatius, I'm very sincere when I say that too, that we all collectively do it together. And so I want to acknowledge the work that you do in making sure that we have an inclusive community as well. And what I meant by that, what I think is, I appreciate that because there's actually context to it. There were many individuals who were working to advance these interests, but just growing up, I was not aware of them and it was not visible to me. We did not, as I mentioned, did not have the advent of social media or the internet. The pagers were just coming online. So we didn't have that. And so what I think is important is that we speak out and we're proud of who we are. And it's a process. And we need to be vocal and visible as much as possible. And so your question was about what do we say to those individuals who are looking to be visible? Is that what your question was? Be involved in various entities and communities. We don't all need to be that politician or being in the forefront of the fight. But be present in our respective communities. If you are LGBT, show up at the Women's March. Show up at the airport. Show up at the March for Our Lives. Show up at immigration rights acts so that people can just say, well, you're just like everybody else. This sexual orientation and sexual identity is just one aspect of your life. But I think that's how we change hearts and minds of people slowly, slowly, slowly.
Well, just to add to that, do you have, like now, so obviously now you're super gay and there are a lot of LGBTQ people that can be that for you. So do you have any folks that you could call out that you look up to or...
Yeah, I think even within the LGBT movement, there is work to be done in terms of representing and reflecting a wide array of people and making sure that the LGBTQ and everything in between is well reflected and involved, so that when I go to LGBT national groups too. And Nishas, I think, can also say the same thing. There are only a handful of API members of the LGBT community that are active in this realm, or people of color, or women. So we also need to be as reflective as possible, to be critical of ourselves, to try and create an inclusive environment. As we sit here in San Francisco, just a side note, it is crazy to me. There are two main constituencies in political constituencies in San Francisco that are required to really excel in public service, which is that of the Asian Pacific Islander community and the LGBT community. So if you can find an API LGBT candidate, perhaps then you can have the first openly LGBT mayor in the city of San Francisco. Who knows? But it's something that I know I'd be proud to see.
I have a different perspective, and I don't actually have a question, but I wanted to give you a little context. You came out when you were 21-ish. I was 40 when I came out to myself. Mm-hmm. That was a different era. It is so encouraging to me to hear you talk about how much change we've managed to make in those intervening years. I participated in most of those marches, and I still do, even though I'm, you know, really up there in the years. I wanted to say thank you for being who you are and being public about it. It's important to those who are listening to us to know how much we've changed.
Well, I thank you very much for your courage as well. We all have our own journeys and our own timeline, and that's why I feel like it's an obligation that I have, because I am so fortunate that I can frankly feel free to walk around and be who I am without the fear of persecution or being killed, as there are many places in other countries and other regions. But let us not be complacent, because you see stories percolate every day about someone being murdered, being ostracized for being who they are. And so it's our collective obligation to ensure that we can advance that, those interests for everybody. And we can just be celebrated for who we are. But I'll tell you again, as I thought we were in 2018 and I introduced that bill on conversion therapy, I can't tell you how much hate mail I have received from people. And again, those busloads of Californians, not just in the Central Valley, but here in the Bay Area, busloads who have written and called an onslaught of outreach and opposition to this. So the challenges that we face are still very real. So let us be as interconnected to communities as possible and build off of the successes that we've made. Thank you.
Hi there. You got engaged in politics at a really young age. I'm just curious, what prompted you to take that first step into running for city council member at 21? And kind of a broader question, how do we engage more young people to engage in politics today, even just getting them to the voting booth? Apparently, about half of 18 to 24-year-olds don't vote. Mm-hmm. So any personal methods that you've used?
Yes. You know, I got involved because I was angry. I was angry in terms of my identity as an Asian Pacific Islander first. Again, I was seen as a perpetual foreigner, something I'm fourth generation, but yet I'm not truly American. I had to demonstrate my patriotism or love of this country. There was also an issue at this time with Abercrombie & Fitch. Abercrombie & Fitch had these racist depictions of these T-shirts of the Asian community, citing signage of phrases like two Wongs make it white, W-H-I-T, and it showed Asians in laundry mats with very discriminatory images of depictions. And so a number of students, I was a student at the time, we protested at the various malls of Abercrombie & Fitch and put little slips in their clothes, and we got kicked out, and I thought I was in trouble because I was going to go to jail, but it was just mall security. And it was such an exhilarating experience that I said, oh, let's go to the next mall and do it again. But that was sort of my first entree into just activism. There, at the same time, there was a petition on a gentleman by the name of Wen Ho Lee, who was an engineer and a scientist who was thought to be a spy. And in fact, he was an American, and he was actually deemed to not be a spy. So the challenges facing one community, and then as I explored my identity, I found this other community and said, oh, there's discriminatory practices, and injustices in the LGBT community, I also want to be active in part of that too. And then, of course, when you get into part of that, then you get into just public service in general and talk about the basic fundamental inequities that exist in the society. And if we don't have love of each other as basic human beings, how can we even tackle the issues of affordable housing or healthcare or public safety or any of the other issues? But I got involved predominantly because I didn't see anybody that I felt represented my values or interest. And as a younger person, I felt that those issues were being lost. And so that's how I got involved. And so how do we get more people involved? I think it is by the internships and mentoring of other people by saying, again, not everyone needs to be that politician because it is, frankly, not easy. It is a very difficult task, but it's also an honor. But how do we spend some time with intentionality about being engaged and involved? In other words, what do I do every morning or what do I do every day to be interconnected in each other's share of success? And that's fundamentally what it's about. So much of us have focused on just surviving, which I understand is important in the Bay Area. It's difficult just to simply survive. But can we spend an hour or two of my time a week to give back to the community, be a place of worship or to serve at a food bank or whatnot, and or to register people to vote? And there are many organizations, whether or not Asian Pacific Islander LGBT, whether it be GAPA, to be involved in those organizations or the LGBT Center or serving on a board or commission of a city, I think is very important. But if we're not awake, if we haven't been awakened by what you see at the federal administration, I don't know what will. But let us use this as an learned moment, an opportunity.
Oh my gosh, that Abercrombie and Fitch, you
remember. I see, a lot of members don't remember.
I still remember, and now I'm just like, man, like traumatized, you know, traumatized LGBT
API. Yes, you remember.
API. Yes. Yeah, that was so horrible. Any other questions for Evan from our audience?
I have a question, actually. As I forget it, of course. Well, actually, you're the head of the LGBT caucus in the state legislature, right?
Yes.
Talk about the other members of it. What do you folks do? Who are some of the other leaders? Obviously, we all know in this area, Scott Weiner. Who are some of the other leaders that you see in there? And what are your goals?
Even as I speak, I sort of get chills when you talk about that recognition, and I sort of take it for granted. But yes, I have the distinction and honor of being the chair of the LGBT Legislative Caucus. That is the basically a grouping of LGBT legislators in the state legislature. So out of 120 legislators in the state of California, we have 8 openly gay LGBT legislators, by the way, which is the most in any other state in the nation. So more gay LGBT legislators than any other state in the nation. And if you had asked me when I was young and back in 2004 when I was running proud or being open and saying I'm gay, like that is the title, like you are gay, I probably would be very uncomfortable with it and just probably just stayed in my room and not wanted to even be that. But now, I don't hide from it. I'm proud, and it is the title. And that is my job, to be chief gay and representing our, define every as you will. But our job is to get openly LGBT people elected. Mm-hmm. And imagine this. There are many stories, whether it be Carol Migdon or Mark Leno here in San Francisco, in which they tell stories how they were the only ones in the legislature. And when you had pro-LGBT legislation on adoption or marriage, you'd have Republican legislators putting up their mic, associating the LGBT community with bestiality, or saying that we are abhorrent, or putting up the Bible, and or frankly walking out of the room when an LGBT legislator was talking. This is just within a decade or so time in the state of California, in which that would happen. LGBT legislators, that's why I talk about, I stand on the shoulders of those who have come before me, because they were subjected to some really horrible things. Whereas we fast forward to our now, the leader of the Senate is a lesbian from San Diego. And so you can imagine what would happen if a Republican did that today. That legislator would probably not have much legislative success in the California state legislature. But that's why being present is so important. Absent that, being present, being at the table, there is no if, ands, or buts about it. There is meaning and value towards it. And by the way, we're changing hearts and minds because people see they're just like everybody else. and a vulnerable just as everybody else.
Absolutely. Speaking of caucuses, you also are part of, and I think started, the Tech and Innovation Caucus for California. So let's talk about, you know, just some work around there.
Yeah, my district is Silicon Valley, and the challenge that we're at now is what we've referred to as the future of work. So what do we do when you have autonomous vehicles that are replacing truck drivers, or how we have normal delivery, or drones replacing security guards, or that of hotel workers and Airbnb, and not necessarily paying in terms of the same framework on taxes to localities, or how many people still have landlines? Vast majority, 95% of households in the state don't have landlines.
95%?
95%.
Wow.
And so when you take away from the copper wire, you don't have individuals that are going to these centers and maintaining those lines because you have broadband and other connectivity. So the retraining of skill sets is very important. And so what is the state of California doing to address the technology that exists, but also having the protections and the structure in place for the future of work? And that is a very difficult task to be able to do.
Yeah, it brought up in my mind, you know, this question of net neutrality. And we're kind of in this limbo period, not sure how it impacts. And I know California is a leader in resisting, right, the net neutrality decision that the FCC had just changed. If you could talk a little bit about that, because I think that that also impacts households who may have a lack of technology, if you will, in California.
Yeah, we have a bill pending in the state legislature now to address that, to make sure that we provide the same type of Obama regulations and rules for the average consumer. And at the same time, not everyone in the state of California has access. And in fact, California is we have a lot of issues and challenges. Of course, we're talking technology here, but look at the wildfires that are happening. This is a constant. This is a continuum. Yeah. And so how do we not talk about the issue of climate change as a real reality that Californians are facing every day? And it is much more difficult to get connectivity in these other regions. So these are topics of conversations that make sure that we have the technologies, not just for the Bay Area and our major metropolitan areas, but throughout the vast entirety of the state of California, which, by the way, is the fifth largest economy in the world now. Mm-hmm. But we have vast differences in the industries that we have in the state.
I've got to ask, we talk a lot, obviously, about the California Democratic Party and how, you know, supermajorities and everything. Do you think the future of the California Republican Party is Arnold Schwarzenegger or John Cox? How do you think they're going to evolve?
If you actually take a look at voter registration on Democrat or Republican, the fastest growing demographic or voters' identification is independent or declined estate.
Yeah.
And that is because there is such a dissatisfaction with those of the party's apparatus. So we are seeing now that a lot of the Republicans are more like the Arnold Schwarzeneggers, are more moderate. The definition of a Republican in the state of California is very different from a Republican in any other area.
Yeah.
Then again, similarly, a definition of a Democrat in California is very different from a Democrat in Arkansas or at other places as well, too. So it's a wide spectrum. And unfortunately, it is difficult to pigeonhole an individual. And just saying by a Democrat, there are many shades of Democrats, just as there are many shades of Republicans as well. But again, that's where it goes back to that basic connection of humanity.
Yeah.
And understanding an individual, not by labels, but as an individual. And that's hopefully how we change hearts and minds.
Evan, I'm so thankful and so grateful for you being here, being part of the program. And I've been sitting here for the last 50 minutes. And if you'll entertain me in my vulnerability here, just fighting with myself whether to ask you about this question. And it has to do with, you know, opening up about talking about these private detention centers. And so there is an article out there in talking about taking right campaign finance money and this rumor or not a rumor or a fact of taking money from GEO Group. And I wanted to ask you about that. And by no means, if I walked out of here without asking, I think I would regret it. But if we're going to actually resist and fight back against these private detention centers, I think hitting them where it hurts, their financials, right, and that they can't buy politics, that's also a thought or idea. So I'd love to hear from you, and it's totally okay if you want to say, hey, it's a complex issue and I'm ready to talk about it. But what I'm referring to is, yes, taking campaign contributions from companies like GEO Group.
Yes, and the context for the listeners and to readers is that there was an article that talked about campaign contributions coming from a prison contractor referred to as GEO Group and other politicians who have received such campaign contributions. And what does that mean? And what is the perception oftentimes is reality? And so when I found out about that article, I said to myself, who is GEO Group? Because I wasn't even familiar with this entity. And this campaign contribution happened back in 2016. And when I found out about the campaign contribution and the entity, I said, this is inconsistent with my values, and have donated the resources towards Asian Americans for Community Involvement, that is a nonprofit in the Bay Area that focuses on survivors of torture and immigration. So that there is that. But I also think there's a distinction by looking at an individual's voting record. In other words, our democracy and campaigns are run by public donations, donations that are transparent and publicly disclosed. And so the question really should be, for example, on this case, where is the campaign contributions coming from? And then what is the voting record of that public official? And if there's consistency there, there's distinction. But if, for example, I accept campaign contributions from the NRA, but I'm consistently voting against them, and I have a F- from the NRA, is that considered okay? Or is perception reality that, you know what, we just want absolutism and nothing to do with them? So I think that is also a part of the conversation that should be had that gets lost in it. And then finally, what is done with the campaign contribution? In other words, what do politicians raise money for? And that is also public. So we raise money to get more Democrats elected so that we have supermajorities in the state of California, so that we can pass the policies that we believe in. But I would just caution readers and just average individuals by looking at campaign contributions as a nefarious thing. In other words, the reality is that campaigns cost money. Right. And it's important to look at that. But the reality should be, let us do that much, the next step of work by saying, where's the campaign contribution coming from? And then what is the voting record with respect to that entity? And then is there an association related to that? And then asking that public official accordingly so that there is complete sense of accountability and transparency in this process. So I use this simile as a learned moment to say, okay, while my voting record does not reflect that of this entity, perception oftentimes is reality. Mm-hmm. And so how do you articulate that accordingly? Which is why I also contributed back that donation to nonprofit, just like 25 other legislators right. have done. So again, this is about a movement, and what do we expect from our public officials? And oftentimes there's a higher threshold and higher bar for that.
Oh, thank you so much for that. I mean, hey, look, this show is funded by corporations that sometimes I'm like, what are you doing? So I completely understand that. And so the question really was by no means, you know, criticism, but just a learning mm-hmm. a situation. And I'm so relieved. I think I'm so relieved. I'm going to celebrate and have sex or something tonight. That was just so wonderful. I was like this, you know, because there's so much respect for you, Evan, and being an inspiration for even, you know, myself in doing this kind of work and asking these types of questions. John, any other questions before we let Evan do real?
I'm not trying to top that, however. one question I was going to ask you was kind of like, how does the 28th, is that the district? How does that district maybe differ from others? You kind of got into that when you were talking about the technology, Silicon Valley. Are there other ways in terms of, does it have a higher than normal immigrant population? I mean, what are some of the other distinctions about your district? How do you go about serving them?
Well, you think about the companies that exist, Apple or Netflix and eBay, and you talk about the workforce. Just think about this is what I wake up and think about and lose sleep at night for, which is that we're setting up Californians for failure, not for success. We talk about the social contract of young people getting the skill sets to become productive members of society by getting educated. Well, when you have only 10% of students graduating within 4 years at San Jose State University, mm-hmm. only 10%. So now they're 5 years. And by the way, tuition from 1960, which almost is essentially free because of the California Higher Education Master Plan, to where we are today, students are graduating with debt. And then talk about rent. Even making six figures, very difficult to live in the Bay Area. So how are we as a state setting up individuals for success when in previous generations, like my grandparents, worked two jobs, work in a cannery and work part-time at a Chinese restaurant as a busser. That was sufficient income to put four children through school and to save up for a home. You can't do that today. That's not the California American dream. So again, it's our obligation to advance the interest and identify how we make systemic changes for these things. So we can celebrate the successes and the riches. Many other states and many other communities would die to have Apple in their jurisdictions. Mm-hmm. But there are also other unintended consequences and associated impacts that we need to make corrective changes. And that's where we need to make sure that we are holding all parties accountable to address these issues.
Well, and when you do that, when you meet with other legislators and try to get things, their districts might be very, very different from this Shangri-La that we kind of live, this uber expensive Shangri-La we live in. I remember this coming up in a discussion back when there was housing. Well, I mean, there still is housing problems, but I mean, there was legislation that was trying to get through Sacramento, dealing with housing things that we definitely have here in San Francisco, our problems. And some commentator was pointing out, yeah, that's not necessarily how it is in other parts of the state. So making that argument that we need this statewide law to deal with this problem here in San Francisco, and you know, in some other more rural or smaller, more spread out city, they might be thinking, I don't need this law. Do you ever have find that disconnect with legislators from other parts of the state?
Yes. I mean, the limited resources, we talk about the state of California and the Bay Area delegation talking about the issues of affordable housing. Mm-hmm. And of course, with policy changes, then do we have the resources to develop to that? But in other parts of the state, they may say, no, we don't want resources to go to affordable housing because that's not necessarily an issue to us. But we might say, let's say wildfires or infrastructure or connectivity or broadband, whatever the issues might be. So it is a difficult balance. But again, that's why understanding legislators and their motivations in their districts is very important so that you can try to help where you can, such that then they can sacrifice perhaps of themselves to say, we're going to also support you in other ways.
So are you going to like a lot of redneck bars now with legislators?
I try to limit those as much as possible.
I was going
to
say, I think I'm going to do that. No. Well, we're going to let you go because you have very important work to do. But I do have one last question. And what does, when you're not Assembly Member Evan Lowe, what does Evan do when he lets his hair down? When she lets her hair down. Yeah. What do you like? What do you do? What do you do for fun when you don't need to be Assemblymember Evan Lowe?
I know it sounds like a very political answer, but this job I very much love and appreciate. This is a calling, and I don't feel like this is a job. This is just something that I would be doing anyway. And so I'm such a fortunate individual to be able to do things that I'm very passionate and I love to do.
No, I'm not going to let you off the hook. No. Okay, fine. What about your favorite TV show?
I don't watch TV.
Say the Michelle Meow show.
Yeah. Yes, the Michelle Meow show. There you go.
Okay, I've got a
John's good save.
Yeah. I've got a question. So you were a really young city council member. You're a really young mayor. You're a really young state legislator. And how old are you?
35 now.
So you actually could be running for president. You're old enough constitutionally. So what's your campaign slogan going to be for 2020?
You really must not like me if you want to subject me to the same things that the federal government you get subjected to. When I ran for office, when I ran for a student body vice president when I was in school, the slogan was aim high, get low. And so anyway, that's kind of
wow. I love that.
It actually was aim high, get low, vote for Evan Lowe. But then other students said, aim high, get high. And then vote for Evan Lowe. And so they sort of twisted it a little bit too. But
on that note, thank you, Evan. Thank you so much for joining us here on this program. A true leader and true and genuine and probably one of the most authentic, political leaders that we have today. So we're very lucky to have you.
Thank you very much. Pleasure. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for joining us for the Michelle Meow Show, your A through Z covering the LGBT, LMNOP, and everyone in between. We're here every Thursday live at the Commonwealth Club, and you can listen to past shows at
commonwealthclub.org/MMS.